Hey, welcome to the Missio Day podcast. Check us out on the web at missiodaychicago.com.
Jeremy Courtney, he's co-founded an organization called Preemptive Love, an organization I've been following for several years, since probably about 3 or 4 years I've been following along what they've been doing in Fallujah, and so I'm not going to share everything for him and let him do that. But we wanted to bring him here because we knew that he was in Chicago. We wanted to also just develop, not just like a one-time, hey, come share with us and make us feel really guilty for all the things we do in Chicago, especially after the Cubs are going to the World Series. I mean, it's easy to like hear a talk like this coming up and feel these weird emotions of like, I feel so superficial. I love the Cubs. Anyway, at least maybe that's just me. I'm projecting onto you. But the thing is, man, we have so many needs in our city that I think as a church, in a city church, it's really hard to keep our mind globally sometimes because God has brought the nations to Chicago. Yes, he has. We're here to, you know, work with immigrants and refugees, and we do that. But man, God is like at work across the globe, and we want to develop partnerships with people who are serving God's kingdom. And Jeremy is one of those people that we just want this to be, I hope he's okay with it, but we want to kind of just get to know you, be partners, be friends, help you, pray for you. So guys, this is not like that was a cool speaker. This is like, we want to lock arms and know that like when you're back in Iraq, like you can visually remember George Washington bus over here and you can be like, man, that community, every time I see a $1 bill, Lincoln Square is praying for me. All right. So that's what we're asking you to do. And then we'll be promising to pray for you every time we hear of Iraq. And so, without further explanation, would you guys give a warm Missio Day welcome to Jeremy Courtney?
Wow, so Brian has set the bar really low. Apparently this should be a guilt-inducing speech that makes you feel bad that the Cubs are going to the World Series. So I moved to Iraq with my wife and our one-year-old baby girl in the middle of the Iraq War. It's been about 10 years ago, middle of the war, height of sectarian conflict, Sunni and Shia bloodletting taking place all over the country, and I'm sitting safely one day ensconced behind these huge bomb blast walls in a hotel, in a cafe, sitting at a table, and this chai guy kind of saunters up to me and sets a cup of tea down on the table and hovers awkwardly over my shoulder for about 30 seconds too long, and I kind of look up at him and I'm like, yes, what's up? And he goes, well, Mr. Jeremy, you've been coming to my hotel, to my cafe here for a while now. Can I ask you a favor? I said, yeah, go ahead. He says, well, I've got this cousin. She's about yay big now, but when she was born with this huge hole in her heart. And there's not a doctor or a hospital left in all of Iraq that can save her life. After all these decades of dictatorship under Saddam Hussein and war with Iran and sanctions from the UN and now Al-Qaeda's killing off our surgeons one by one, we just don't have anyone left. You clearly came here to help us. You're an American. You're a Christian. We've talked about this. I was just wondering, would you help us, like my actual family, my actual cousin? And one thing led to another, and our family decided to throw our weight behind this family and cast our lot with theirs and see what we could do to help this one little girl. Fast forward a couple of weeks and then a couple of months, and we decided to really start an organization that was committed to little girls like her and little boys like her, these kids that had been left behind, environmental fallout from chemical warfare from Saddam Hussein. U.S. weapons were very much implicated in the massive rise of birth defects across Iraq. Everywhere we went, we saw kids with spinal bifida and cerebral palsy and heart defects. And I went to Fallujah under the cover of night and was snuck in and met with doctors and nurses who showed me horrific, horrific babies with one eye in the middle of their head and the brain born outside their body and just the things of war that don't really make news here very often. And this became our daily reality. And these became the daily stories and our friends that we were interacting with. And we wanted to test this idea in a time, in a situation, in a milieu of preemptive strikes, where everyone was saying, we got to go get Saddam before Saddam can get us. We got to jump forward and hit them before they can hit us. We wanted to test this idea. Would it be possible to really, truly take Jesus at his word? To really be a people that would love our enemies? And could we actually not be a people of preemptive strikes, but could we dare to be a people of preemptive love? Could we actually reach across enemy lines? Could we even question if all these enemy lines that have been supposedly drawn in the sand are truly enemy lines in the first place? Maybe they're not even enemy lines. And could we dare to walk closer to the things that scare the hell out of us and dare to love anyway? And so we've been doing that now for the last 10 years, and I'll skip over a lot of the story, but as we contemplate, as I know you've been contemplating these questions of resurrection, as you've been interacting with this idea of, can there really be a life after death? Can there really be such a power in the world that would bring dead things to life? Is there such a power? Is there such a spirit? Is there such a God that can cause bad things to come untrue? My team was walking through the death fields of ISIS just some months ago in a town that had just recently been liberated. Do we have some of these slides that are working? There's a maybe about halfway down. You can just kind of scroll through, and I'll tell you to stop when we get close. But we were walking through this field, and keep going. If you can see where the coming up on next, maybe a few more right here. It died. Awesome. Okay. Well, it was amazing. Our team is walking through this town that has, let me think how to tell this story. All right. You may remember, middle of 2014, ISIS kind of bubbles up from inside Iraq, inside this massive city called Mosul, a city that had been very much under the foot of Shia oppression for some years, and the Sunni population inside the city, now disenfranchised, disempowered, economically disadvantaged, starts to get a desire to push back, to fight back against the oppression. And so there's mafia-like realities going on. There's these ideas, and there's this group on the scene who's saying, we'll liberate you. We'll set you free. We'll push out the Shia oppressors, and we'll actually give you the freedom that you deserve. And this group is called ISIS. They don't really start out as this marauding, beheading terrorist organization like we so simply think of them today. They actually started something like a freedom movement, saying, you don't deserve to be treated like this. We can be the ones who push off the oppressor and give you the freedom and the dignity that you need. And so inside Mosul and ISIS members flowing across from Syria kind of amassed this pushback against the Iraqi government and push the Iraqi military out of Mosul. And then they show their true colors, or they somehow metastasize and change some of their true agenda, and they actually become something more terroristic in nature. They become more oppressive themselves, and the very thing that was supposed to liberate the people ends up oppressing the very people that they were speaking to and claiming to help. And so they start making their way across Iraq. First, they overrun the city of Mosul. They go house to house and ask neighbors, who is this person, and who lives here, and who lives here? And they start marking the homes of Christians for extermination. And they take red spray paint and they spray the red letter N on the doors of Christians and on the walls of Christian homes. N, Nazarene. Pejorative term to say these people follow the Nazarene, and their homes are ours for expropriation and their lives are ours for extermination because they are not of us. And so they start marking Christians' homes and saying, we're coming for you. And after they finish that genocidal act, then they turn to the hinterlands of the city of Mosul, and they start marauding their way through this group of villages that is known to be the homeland for a small little group of people called the Yazidi, an ethno-religious group that hails from Zoroastrian roots, much maligned by a group like ISIS, accused of being devil worshippers, accused of being fire worshippers. They don't have a scripture. They're not people of the book like we would be considered people of the book. And so they fall outside of many of the historic protections, the warfare kind of rules of war and rules of engagement that would apply to Christians. Christians actually got a pretty good, I don't want to say it that way, Christians actually didn't get the worst treatment over the last couple of years at the hands of ISIS. Christians were actually protected by some things that our Yazidi friends were not protected by. And so they were deemed total infidels without protection. And as ISIS marauded their way through their villages, they captured their girls and their women en masse. 5,000, maybe 7,000 girls were abducted and subjected to the predations of these ISIS fighters. Their men, 5, 10, maybe 15,000 men were still uncovering mass graves, were captured and slaughtered en masse and put in the ground. And those who weren't captured or killed ran for their lives. And so now today we've got something like 3.5 million people who have been displaced from their homes and are living in school buildings like this and half-built houses that didn't get finished and camps and tent-like settings, trying to figure out what they can do to stay alive now in the second full year of this conflict, going into the third year of this conflict. And as the Iraqi army has then pushed back and the Kurdish militia has pushed back against ISIS, little bit by little bit, these towns have been liberated. And we get to go in and do these autopsies and see what ISIS is like or what ISIS was like when they ruled this land. We breeze through a couple of photos of me standing in this church where ISIS had just been driven out of this area. And they went into these churches and they shot up the crosses and they destroyed the altars and they shot through the icons. Anything to say this is not true. This is not of us. We rule this place now. And in the Yazidi temples and the Yazidi villages, they did the same. And so our team is walking through this field, literally just a vast open field, and stumble upon a couple of photos down from this, and this is graphic, a mass grave. Something that has not been discovered yet. Something that none of the officials have shown up to actually document it. The UN hasn't been there. There's no protective fence around it. And our team just stumbles on this. Will it just not play? Okay. God is protecting you from seeing these difficult images. But literally just walking up on a set of friends, people, beloved of God, there on the ground. The sun has bleached out their bones. Their clothes are still hanging over their femur and over their arms, and their prayer beads are in their hands, and their foot bones are still inside their sandals, and they're just there, right there in front of us. Middle of winter, cold, death everywhere. I mean, we're just walking up on a scene of death, and it was really just a harrowing thing for our team to see and to go through, traumatizing in a very real way. I mean, the land was relatively safe now. You could actually still see the ISIS flag on the horizon. So this village is free, but just right there, that village is not. And our team moves on, and we're working in this town and trying to see what we can do to rehabilitate these people and help them find their way back to normalcy. And we leave and go about our work over the next couple of months and continue to invest in the lives of these Yazidi friends and Christian friends and Muslim friends who have come from these areas. One of the things that my wife has been working on in earnest over the last couple of years is helping these women who have lost their husbands, who have lost their children to ISIS, who fled up this mountain like treeing an animal or something, as ISIS surrounded them and they fled up this mountain in search of safety. And ISIS surrounded the mountain. You may remember these harrowing scenes from August 2014, aerial footage of people just stranded on a mountain with ISIS at the bottom. And this question was, will we respond? Are we going to attack ISIS on the one hand? Are we going to actually provide humanitarian response on the other hand? And so these are the people that my wife has been working with and we've been working with as an organization. And over the course of trying to help rehabilitate these communities and bring them back from the dead, so to speak, bring them back to life, my wife will go in and spend time with these women, get to know them, love them, and ask them, how can we help you find your way back? How can we empower you to make money for yourself again? You don't have to just sit in this tent and wait for an aid organization to show up and give you more food. Because that was really good and very helpful on day one. And it was very good on month two. But now we're in year three. And it's actually not in your best interest for people to keep showing up and just giving you food week after week after week and paying your rent week after week after week. What you really need this many years into it is the capacity to stand on your own ground, to stand in your own place and say, ISIS will not have the last word in my life. I can make money for myself. I can provide for my children, and I will find my way back from this grave that I've almost been put in. So my wife will go and have these conversations with women and with men and with entire communities and say, how can we help you? How can we empower you to find your way back? And often those early conversations are like, oh, I'm just a dumb villager. Oh, I'm just a poor woman. I don't know how to do anything. But over time, week after week after week, hour after hour, sitting in the mud, my wife works and our team works to inspire these women and empower these women to actually be more than they ever imagined they could be, to do more than they ever imagined they could do. And so one of the things that my wife has been doing is helping start these small little businesses. So we'll help a woman open a small corner store where she's selling things in her camp to other people. So day laborers will go out in their work, and then they need to come home and buy groceries for their family. So we're opening small little grocery stores or small little repair shops here. One of the things she's been doing is helping women reclaim this ancient art in the Middle East of handmade olive oil soap. And drawing from the land, using pure olive oil and creating soap that isn't filled with chemicals and isn't going to hurt their babies and isn't going to cause more allergies when they're living in this kind of already difficult environment and they don't have money to go to the doctor and they don't have money to deal with extra problems in their life. And so these women are now rallying around each other and creating these products with their own hands in their tents, in their place of displacement. And then they're selling this soap to the communities around them, selling these soaps in the market, selling these soaps here in the U.S., and then making money to help put their lives back in order. And so she went to this community and said, how many of you want to start a job? How many of you want to start making money for yourself? And most of these women just demurred and said, we're just dumb women. We're just dumb villagers. We don't know how to do anything like that. But one or two women raised their hand and said, yeah, we're into it. We're bored. We have nothing else to do anyway. And so she started working with these women, and they made this soap, and then it came time to sell their soap to market. My wife came back and helped them sell their soap to market and put in their hands more money than they probably ever held in their entire life. During their village years, during their healthy years, before ISIS came to town, they'd never actually made so much money for themselves as they did in this 1 minute of good, hard work. And these women were so overwhelmed with joy. They were in a period of mourning. Their children had been killed. Their husbands and brothers and uncles had been killed. But they were so overcome with emotion and so overcome with joy that they actually pulled their scarves over their faces to try and hide the joy, to try and hide the smiles, to try and hide the life that was bubbling up from inside them. And the other 10 women who didn't choose to opt into the program were scowling from a distance. Why are these women acting like that? Why are they so filled with joy? Don't they know that's not proper? We're in a period of mourning. We're not supposed to have life bubbling out from inside us. We're supposed to be sad right now. They're covering their faces, but my wife says their eyes still just shone forth so much joy and so much life. And after putting that money in their hands, and after this joy just kind of emanating its way out into the community, my wife asked again, how many women want to sign up, start making your own money, start finding your way back to life? And everyone raised their hand. Everyone was in. And so my wife's been working with this community, and now we're doing all these various things, creating handmade olive oil soap, creating beautiful luxury handmade candles, and corner stores for women, and repair shops for men, and it's bringing communities back to life. A couple months later, we were back in this same field, walking through the same exact area that we had stumbled on that mass grave before. And we came upon it a second time. And it was spring now. It wasn't winter anymore. and coming up through the very same skeletons, coming up through the very same bones, were these flowers, literally out of the mass grave, literally out of death, literally bursting forth from the grave was life. And it just would not be denied. Like the life coming up out of those women and shooting out of their eyes and affecting their entire community and bringing their community back to life. These flowers wouldn't be denied, and the life itself wouldn't be denied. And I noticed it first in the mass grave. I noticed it first because it was so starkly different than what we had seen before. I mean, when you see a flower coming through a skull, it catches your attention. But as I lifted my eyes and then took note of what was around me, the entire field, the entire countryside was filled with these bright yellow flowers. And the very place that ISIS had just walked, the very place that ISIS had just killed so many thousands, was literally teeming with life. And it was just this wonderful reminder that life will not be denied. There is life after death. There is a power big enough to bring life through the very dead things, the very hopelessness, the very thing that would lay us flat and want to render us useless. This field of flowers has become a bit of a metaphor and a hope on the horizon for me of all of what we aim to do in places like Iraq and in Syria, where every day you see stories of the Bashar al-Assad regime bombing people to smithereens in Aleppo. And if you're following the news, you're watching the fight against ISIS in Mosul right now. And so as an organization, as a team, as a community, as a family, we continue to invest in this idea. We continue to experiment with this thesis that we actually can, if we take Jesus seriously, we can be a people of preemptive love. We can jump forth to love you before you do anything to love me. We don't have to be reactive, and we don't have to be defensive. We don't have to jump forward to kill you before you kill me, because there is something about laying down our life for the other. There's something about even dying that brings forth more life and more hope itself. And this is the Jesus way. Now, Brian asked me to just say some of those opening remarks before we actually open it up for something a little different that I don't think you guys do hear very often, but just have more of a conversation, because I know this is in the news. And it can be scary at times, and there's different things that you've seen, and there's different stories you've heard, and it can be hard to get some kind of cohesive story about what's going on in places like Syria and Iraq. And so we wanted to transition for a minute into just a time of conversation. So Brian may have some opening questions, I don't know, but as quickly as possible, we're going to move to just a time of talking together. And I want to be a helpful resource for you, and I want to just be able to help add some clarity and maybe some fuel in your tank as you seek to love here locally this Syrian family that you've just adopted as a church, and as you engage your Muslim neighbors, and as you try to figure out how a city church also has a global love. So, Brian.
Yeah, thank you guys. Can you guys give Jeremy a hand for being here, just his presence? Thanks, Jeremy, for being here, man, making time for us. First of all, provide a little bit of a backstory. First of all, how many, you're married, kids?
Yeah, we've been married 15 years. We have two kids. Our daughter is 11, and Emma, and our son Micah is 9.
Nice. And then you guys, take me back to when you decided to move your family to Iraq. What was going on? Tell me that whole story, because that seems like everybody would advise you during that time, this may not be the wisest thing to do. Tell me a little bit about how that happened.
Yeah, I was coming out of a class at Baylor University in September 2001 when I started hearing these rumors that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. And then a few steps further down the hall, it seemed another plane had crashed into another building, and then another plane had crashed into another building. And the whole world changed that day. It wasn't just a terrorist attack. It wasn't just like Pearl Harbor. It was something actually very different. Our temple had been destroyed. Our temples had been destroyed. and America itself and the idea of America and the ideas of capitalism and the ideas of democracy were very much under attack and under question. And suddenly our financial institutions weren't as stable as we thought they were. Our very Defense Department and the freedom that we have always felt like we derived from that wasn't as stable and impenetrable as we thought it was. And I think a lot of us, for a lot of us, the entire world changed that day. And Baylor is in the heart of Texas, and most of my friends and most of the people surrounding me adopted a posture that more or less said, let's turn Afghanistan into a parking lot. Let's make the desert glow. Let's kill the raghead Muslims. That was normal. That was church talk for me, for us. And we were blessed, if just barely, to be around a couple of pastors, a couple of mentors who, while our body might have been headed in that direction, they managed to turn our head just slightly toward a way of love. And as we dared to turn our head just a little bit more toward our Muslim friends, it turns out that our body eventually followed. And so we started swimming upstream just a little bit from those ideas. Now, we launched out into the Muslim world, into the Middle East, so to speak, thinking that we were the right ones, thinking that we were so different than those other people back in Texas who just wanted to destroy the Muslims. It took me a number of years to realize that actually there was so much of that posture, so much of that militancy, so much of that anger that I never left behind. I just shrouded it in something a little more palatable. I shrouded it in a kind of theology. I shrouded it in a kind of self-righteousness, a Christian self-righteousness that made the pill go down a little bit better. And so I'm sitting in a conference in the Middle East having a conversation about why can't we all, those of us at this conference, manage to convert more Muslims? Why can't we manage to make more Muslims become Christians? And I'm laying on the floor praying, crying out to God, why aren't you doing anything through me, God? I've moved my family here. I'm out every day telling the story, battling like Paul does so that people would become Christian, and you're not doing anything. And this is miserable. I came here to plant churches. I came here to make converts. Where are you, God? And maybe the one time in my entire life I would say, I think maybe I heard from God, the word that I think maybe I heard was, because you don't love them. And everything after that I'm about to say is commentary. But what I got out of that was, why would I do anything through you? You don't love Muslims. You don't love Muhammad sitting on the other side of the table from you as Muhammad, full stop. Period. You only love the Muhammad that you can change to be a Christian so that he can be Muhammad, the former Christian that Jeremy had a significant role in making a no longer a Muslim a Christian. That's not about love. That's about Jeremy. That's about winning. That's about arrogance. That's about being right. I'm not going to do anything through that guy. And still face down on the floor, it was like I, in my prayer mind, I could see myself talking to God. And the conversation looked a lot like this. I had my fists up. I was looking for a fight. And sure enough, everywhere I went, I managed to get a fight. I could argue with Muslims about anything. I could walk in, meet a Muslim, and Muslim guy would say, oh, you're a Christian. We're the same. Brother, come have baklava. And I would be like, whoa, 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 whoa. We're not the same. Chill out. Hold up. Let me tell you all the ways we're different. And he'd say, yeah, yeah, but we both worship the same God. And I'd say, whoa, 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 hold up, throw another right hook. I found a way to destroy every act of hospitality that Muslims kept trying to welcome me into. We both follow Jesus. I love Jesus. Whoa, 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 you don't love Jesus the way I do. Let me tell you about Jesus. Well, I believe that Jesus died on the cross, and the Quran says that Jesus was raised up to God. Hold up, let me throw another right punch here because you don't believe that the way I do. And everything was a fight. And I knew how to turn every overture of kindness from Muslims into an apologetic
argument, you know?
And in that moment, now back at the conference, face down on the ground, praying to God, fist up, I think when God said, because you don't love them, I saw my fist come down. I saw my arms open out into a posture of embrace. And in that very moment, the power to be different came with that word, you don't love them. With the conviction came the power to be different. And before I had even stood up in the real world from that prayer, I truly believe I was a totally different person. And I've never, ever, in however many 13 plus years it's been now, I've never argued with a Muslim like that again. I've never sought to win in the same way that I did before that moment of conversion in my own heart. And what I realized reflecting on that later is I never gave up the desire to destroy Muslims. I didn't want to do it with a gun because that was unsavory to me. I didn't want to turn Afghanistan into a parking lot per se. But I still held so much hatred for Muslims and Islam in my heart that all I could think about, all that was driving me, was still a desire to obliterate Islam and to obliterate Muslims and make them Christians. That was the operating worldview that I had at that time. And I'm not sure if that's, I don't think that's the way of love. That's what that moment of prayer was for me. As I stood up from that prayer moment, this was all in the pre-Iraq days, and I think that held significant sway in ultimately compelling us to go to Iraq. I don't know that the Jeremy who destroys Muslims through conversion person would have ended up in Iraq doing the things that we're doing today, but the converted Jeremy who wanted to learn how to live a life of sacrificial love ended up with our family moving in the middle of the Civil War to try and help.
So once you had this conversion, everything from that point got really easy for you, right? I mean, no, tell us, what's the hardest thing that you and your family have had to go through while in Iraq?
I mean, we've had seasons of difficulty. The first trip I took to Iraq was just to be a scouting trip and try and get a feel for things. I mean, if you can remember back to 2006, there was no good news coming out of Iraq. It was all loss, all bad news. The Bush administration was being eviscerated for the debacle that the war was. This was before we had surged a bunch more troops in and before good news started coming out. And so we wanted to go in. I wanted to go in and see Iraq for myself and try and understand, could I live here? Could I expect my wife to live here? Can we raise a one-year-old baby girl here? Like, this is somehow we're being drawn, and yet I feel very much repelled all at the same time. And so I land in Iraq and go through some days of scouting and trying to understand what's going on. And, you know, on the one hand, my host would like put a bulletproof vest on me and duck me into the back of a bulletproof car with glass on the windows this thick. And I'm like, this is insane. Snipers on the wall, bombs going off in the distance, fast evasive maneuvers in the neighborhoods as we drive to try and get from one place to another. I'm like, well, this settles that. This is crazy sauce. There is no way we're moving our family here. And then we would duck into a hovel or a house or something and have a conversation. And I'd hear the people. I'd hear their stories. I'd hear their hope. I'd hear their desperation. I'd hear their pain. I'd hear their dreams. And I would be just caught up in the beauty and the pain of it all and think, safely inside this room for a minute, looking you in the eye, we have to move here. We have to be a part of this. This is a historic moment, and I don't want to miss out on what's happening here. I don't want to miss out on what God's doing here. Yes, we're moving. And then we walk back out into 127 degree heat where a bomb just went off again in the distance. And it was very much an emotional roller coaster. I moved back to, or I got on the plane back home and met my wife in the living room with some friends at 3 a.m. where they were waiting up for me. And it's like, so how was it? Are we moving? Or, you know, what's up? And I was like, it was amazing. It was horrific. It was beautiful. It was painful. There's no way we're moving there. And my wife, more or less, as I remember it now, said something like, well, we've been praying while you were gone, and we're moving to Iraq. And, you know, a gentle conversation ensued from that point forward that I tried to help her understand that's cute for you to pray and, you know, feel some godly insight from this many miles away, but you don't know what it's like to live without electricity. You don't know what it's like to live without water. You don't know what it's like to see snipers on the roof. You've never seen a bomb go off that close to where we are, and I don't think we can do this. And 6 months later, we sold or packed everything we had and moved from one country to another, and the first 6 months were horrific. I mean, they were horrible. Widespread kidnappings across our city, suicide bombs going off. The war itself, more properly, was still maybe an hour, 2 hours away, but it has ripple effects. And our marriage almost didn't survive 2007. But it did, and we went on to found the organization and start helping kids all over the country. And then a couple of years ago, one of our dearest employees, our closest local Iraqi friends, for reasons that are really complex that I don't even understand, decided to turn on us, decided to betray us. This guy held the keys to the kingdom. He had everything on us. Keys to our house, keys to our car, keys to the office, keys to the safe. I mean, he was the be-all, end-all in our life in terms of making things happen for our family in Iraq. I called him brother. My kids called him uncle. My kids stayed the night at his house, and suddenly overnight, it wasn't really just overnight. There were a series of conflicts, but ultimately, the dam broke overnight, and he set out, I think, primarily to protect himself. He decided to attack us, and he incited tribal violence against us. He went to the government. His dad was a very prominent person and managed to infiltrate a number of government offices and make claims against us that were very serious and very difficult, accused us of trafficking terrorists to America, accused us of engaging in all kinds of corrupt practices. The government actually stepped in and seized my entire family's passports, which is illegal, but they did it anyway. We had no status, no identity anywhere in the country. The State Department offered to issue us fake passports and fake identities to get us out of the country in the middle of the night, but said we'd never be able to come back. And we said, no, like, we're not going to run away from this. We've done nothing wrong. Why would we cast that signal to all the people that we've helped and all the families that we've sat with and all the people we've loved that we're guilty and we're going to run away? He was calling everyone we knew and telling them these salacious stories about us. And I was arrested. Jessica was arrested. I was put in jail. He stalked us. He stalked our kids. He stole our car. I mean, it was a horrific, about 6 months solid of just looking over our shoulder every single day. And the only thing that stopped us from looking over our shoulder was because right in the middle of that, ISIS rose up in the desert and captured every other ounce of energy that we had and that anyone had in the country. And so we turned from being chased by one predator to feeling like we were having to make these other calculations about ISIS. Should we stay? Should we go? How do we respond now to millions of people being displaced around us? And
that's
subsided in many ways, but out of that season of pain and out of that season of conflict, I feel like we've come into this season that I just described to you. I mean, that was sort of our own mass grave in a way before we've come into this era of life ourselves. We feel more fully alive. We feel like flowers blooming in the countryside more than we ever have before. But it really did have to come through that season of death. We lost our best friend. I lost my brother. My kids lost their uncle. And it was exceedingly painful. But that too, because we stuck with it, I think has opened up into vistas of new life for us as well.
Thanks for sharing that, just so we can have a way to continue to pray and just to peer into your past a little bit. And I think someone with the sustainability you guys have, and there's always pain involved with resurrection and always death. And one more question, just to kind of catch us up to speed with like what's going on in Iraq now, and then I want to open it up for you guys. Help people who maybe are not following the news really closely with everything in the Middle East, catch us up to speed with what's happening in Iraq right now, and how preemptive love is opening themselves up to serve and love and support those in need.
Yeah, so the good news is, militarily speaking, we're down to the last major ISIS stronghold in Iraq. At the height of things, probably late 2014, mid 2015, ISIS controlled something like a third of the geography of Iraq. And that they didn't have troops in every single spot of that geography. The way Iraq is laid out, I mean, you can control a couple of choke points, a couple of roads, and you can basically cordon off a significant part of the country. But on their way to getting to that 33%, they overran a number of villages and killed off tens of thousands of people. And it was extremely scary, and we didn't know how far they would advance and how far they would go and where would the stop point ever be. It wasn't until U.S. airstrikes started coming against them that things slowed down significantly. And now in the last year and a half or so, as ISIS has kind of fallen out of the news in Iraq, I mean, you're not hearing much about it anymore. You're hearing more about Paris and Brussels and lone wolf attack here or there. The Iraqi army, with some of their various militia component groups, covered by U.S. air strikes, and with a couple hundred all the way up now to about 5,000 U.S. troops on the ground, have been slowly pushing back against ISIS, overcoming ISIS in one town after another. The base of the pyramid, the main body of ISIS fighters, and one of the most significant places that they control in Iraq for all of this time has been the city of Mosul. It's the second largest city in all of Iraq. It's the place that ISIS overran and made world news in June of 2014. It's the place where they went door-to-door marking Christians' homes, and it was out of there that this thing metastasized across so much of Iraq and even Syria. And so now it's been working its way back toward, the fight has been working its way back toward Mosul now. So it started there, spawned out, and then the fight starts out here and has worked its way back toward the center. And that's good news. I mean, we mourn the loss of life. We even mourn the loss of life of those ISIS members and ISIS fighters who have been caught up in this. But ultimately, for the future and the freedom of Iraq and Syria and the world, it is good news that we're down now to the last major stronghold. But it's a major stronghold. It's not like the city of Fallujah, which is actually pretty small, 100,000 some residents. Mosul, we're looking at 1.5 million people still trapped inside the city. We're looking at 1 million people probably being driven from their homes as airstrikes start happening and as troops close in on them. And the humanitarian response is almost certainly not going to be enough. We were front and center for the liberation of Fallujah in May and June. We were the only international organization in the world to fight, to follow the fight and deliver aid inside the Fallujah militarized zone. And we've stayed with the military and stayed with the militia every day since May, following them on their fight against ISIS. And so every time they clear a village, we come in after them and start serving the people in that village. And as such, we're moving up north from Fallujah to Mosul, and now we're encamped basically at the base of the city of Mosul. We've got great access to the people who need it most. As people flee Mosul, they're fleeing right into our arms. There's four major areas. So if this is Mosul, then if you're a person running away from the violence, you could go north, you could go this way, you could go this way, or you could go south. Most of the aid, most of the organizations are here and here, but they are behind a kind of iron curtain. That means you can't get to them,
and they can't get to you because of security protocols. And I'll spare you all the geopolitics on that. But they're basically inside this region that some of you have heard of called the Kurdish region or the Kurdistan region. If I'm Arab and I'm basically viewed to be a terrorist, then they're not going to let me in there. And these organizations can't get outside of the Kurdistan region to work inside of greater federal Iraq. So there's a lot of money here ready to help people. There's a lot of food and money here ready to help people. But so far, people aren't even going those directions because of various geopolitical realities. Everyone so far is flowing this way or this way. And that's where we're positioned to help. It's still in the greater federal Iraq area. And, I mean, ultimately, we hope that this will be operationalized up here, because if it doesn't, then everyone trying to help down here is going to be massively overwhelmed. We're already going to be overwhelmed. But if this flow doesn't happen the way everyone's hoping it will, it's going to be 10 times the problem that it would be otherwise. So,
yeah. Couple of questions. We have time for a few.
It's a great, great question. We describe ourselves as a people, a community that is first in, last to leave. When people are running away from violence, we're running toward the violence to help them. When people are running away from airstrikes, running away from ISIS, we want to go toward them because that's where the help is needed. If we just sit in fallback positions and hope to God they can make it to us, 9 times out of 10, they're not going to be able to cross the various geopolitical lines and security forces that are put in place to protect those people in the fallback positions. So they're going to get stranded out in no man's land. So we run toward them. That's first in. But the last to leave means that we stick around to engage in this kind of small economic, microeconomic empowerment work to make sure that we're rebuilding families, rebuilding communities, helping them find a way back home. We don't just give them aid one time or give them aid for a year on end and never stick around long enough to help them rebuild their own communities and rebuild their own market access and rebuild their own economic, religious, tribal, institutional things that they need to thrive as a community, as a group, as a society. What do we see? What do we long for? We long for the full flourishing of the people of Mosul, for the full flourishing of our Assyrian Christian friends who have been driven from their homeland, for our Yazidi friends who have been driven from their homeland, for our Muslim friends who have been so much maligned in this entire process over the last couple of years that now Muslim or Islam has become yet again a tremendous byword around the world where many people can hardly imagine such a thing as a good Muslim anymore. And so we want to work with and alongside our Muslim friends to make sure that they are flourishing again. The truth on the ground today is you've got Muslim fighters from the Kurdish Peshmerga, from the Shia militia, and from the official Iraqi security forces, Muslims, 99% Muslim forces, who are fighting village by village against terrorists to ensure the freedom of Christians. Muslims fighting terrorists to ensure the freedom and the future of our Christian friends. That's a story that's not getting told around here, around anywhere, really. And the way we design our work, the way we go about working these programs out as a community, whether it's first in aid or long-term economic support, is we make sure that we have multi-ethnic, multi-religious groups working together. So it's not just, let's get a bunch of Sunnis to go help Sunnis because they all get along together. And let's get Christians to help Christians because they all get along together. No, the only way we find our way out of this mess is to make sure that we know each other and make sure that we love each other and find more time exposed to one another. That's where the love grows in the first place. It's hard to love something you don't know. It's hard to love something that you've never experienced. And so we'll put Sunni, Shia, Arab, Kurd, Assyrian, Christian, and Protestant all together wherever we can to go serve a Yazidi community. And in that one moment then, we're challenging at least, if not changing the narrative that Yazidis might hold about Muslims and that Muslims might hold about Yazidis. And you got Christians and Muslims walking hand in hand to serve the other. And in many cases, this whole idea of the other starts to be undercut and falls away at least a little bit over time. We don't want to suggest that we're all exactly the same and that there, I mean, distinctions matter and differences matter. And we're actually stronger when we hold our distinctions in harmony with one another rather than try to obliterate the idea of any distinctions. We are different, but we're not other. We're not ultimately different.
Marcus.
I would describe the spiritual fruit as profound. I don't measure it the way I used to. I don't track it the way that I used to. But I think, first and foremost, in my own life, the spiritual fruit has been profound. In the life of our team and our community, it's been profound. But the very work of the gospel in trying to create a community in which there is neither Jew nor Gentile, male nor female, and all have unfettered access to God, unfettered access to this resurrection life, unfettered access to the thing that makes bad things come untrue and brings life out of death. I think I see that spirit at work in these communities. I see that that energy, that life, that spirit all around us. It doesn't manifest itself in the confessional checkboxes. But organizationally, that's not what we do. Organizationally, that's not something we track. Organizationally, we work to create an environment for people to meet each other on common ground. So we think of ourselves as a faith-based organization. I don't in any way say we're, in trying to draw a distinction to say we're not a Christian organization per se, I don't mean to imply that we're a secular organization. We are a faith-based organization because I want, when I hire a Muslim, I want that Muslim to bring all their faith to the table. I want that Yazidi Zoroastrian, not a fire worshiper, not a devil worshiper, but this Muslim may think they're a devil worshiper. I want them to bring all of their Yazidi faith to the table. And I want my ancient Assyrian friend to bring their historic Christianity the table, and I, as a Protestant from America, I'm going to bring all my faith to the table, and we're going to work faithfully with one another, and the best ideas are going to rise to the top, and the best people are going to influence the other people, and I think that there is a freedom and a hope and a life that I see in that community and the way that we're working that I wasn't able to bring about in the previous ways of working that we tried, that were more driven by that mentality I described earlier, that were driven by certain hiring practices or certain check boxes that would only let you through the door to work for us if you were able to sign confessional statements to this end or that end. And so we, in the community of preemptive love, we work to make sure that everyone has access to each other and trust God for the long-term fruit of what's happening. I needed to make that change in my own life because the way that I had adopted the church planting mindset, the way that I had internalized the missionary mantle that had been handed to me actually didn't make me free. It created a massive burden on me that it just was ill-fitting for me. And it put me, because of who I am and my own issues, it put me in a position where I felt like I had to bring about the salvation of other people. And that just never worked well for me. And what I've moved into now is a season of really trusting that God brings about whatever life change God wants to bring about in people's life. And mine is to be faithful with it. Mine is to be faithful speaking of my faith, speaking of my story, speaking of the story, and seeing life come where life to come.
And I think too, when when we see the gospel as a proposition only, like say these words and you have this eternal transaction that takes place now between you and God, and that's, I don't know, definitely it takes words, but I think Jesus came in the flesh to embody God and to experience Jesus in the flesh. And I'd imagine by taking this approach, you have a lot more people genuinely coming and saying, why are you doing this? Why are you creating this kind of atmosphere that allows you to, if they do want to know more about the Christian faith, they probably feel a lot more freedom to explore. Would you, I don't know if that...
Iraq may be a little bit unlike other predominantly Muslim countries that you heard of. I think Muslim countries in general often get a bad rap that doesn't, that shouldn't even fit the narrative. I think a lot of life, a lot of missions, a lot of this kind of stuff is a bit of a Rorschach test. You look at the ink blot called Jordan, you look at the ink blot called Saudi, you look at the ink blot called Iraq, and someone says, what do you see here? And what you call that ink blot may say as much about you and what's going on in your own psychology and in your own theology and your own socialization as it says about the ink blot itself, as it says about Iraq, as it says about Jordan. And that's, it's okay. I mean, that's just the way psychology works. That's the way socialization works. But if you've experienced the ink blot differently, if you've experienced Iraq differently or Jordan or Muslims in general, then you might be inclined to see a whole different thing there. It's not a dragon blowing fire out seeking to destroy the world. It's a cuddly puppy with its ears raised high. And I mean, your experiences determine how you interpret things. And so for me, I would say Muslims in Iraq, but really more broadly around the world where we work, they know, they already have a fairly profound understanding of Christianity. They already have a fairly profound opinion, positive opinion of Christians. I grew up and I was sent to the Middle East believing that if we did good things, people would come to us and say, why are you doing what you were doing? Then we would preach the gospel. It would be the first time they would ever hear it, and they would become Christians, more or less. That was kind of the formula. And what I found when I got there was we did good things, and we saw right beside us Muslims doing good things. And then we took up hand in hand with one another, and we did more good things. And when I wanted them or expected them to say, why are you doing what you're doing? They already knew why we were doing what we were doing. They already had a very positive view of Muslims. They already had an experience that said Christians are honest, loving, kind-hearted people who run toward danger and run toward violence, and they're generous with their time and their money. I didn't bring light on the scene. I was not the advent of all things godly and holy in Iraq when I arrived, and I actually think that surprised me a little bit.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but if you guys have questions to ask Jeremy afterwards, just real quick, Jeremy, how can we, I mean, massive amount of need coming your way, how can we help just real quick as a community?
I mean, the easiest thing you can do, or the, perhaps it won't be easy, but the most immediate thing you can do is help World Relief. Help with the coat drive. Help take in a second Syrian family. Help do everything you can here locally. Drive 2 miles away and engage your Muslim neighbors. Turn to them when you're walking by them in the street and be kind and be loving. That may not seem like it's going to do much for the 1 million people that we're expecting to land on our doorstep over the next few days and weeks in Mosul, but it will. It actually will. Because if we don't start playing the 30-year trajectory on this thing, if we don't start thinking generationally about this, we're going to have another Mosul next year. We're going to have another Aleppo. We're going to have another Syrian civil war. We're going to see more people displaced. And how we know and love our Muslim neighbors here locally will affect who we elect for president and what kind of foreign policy we have and what kind of border policy we have and how loving or scared we are of people that we deem to be different than us. And if we're doing it to Muslims, then we'll be doing it to our black friends and we'll be doing it to our Asian American friends. And soon there is no difference. If we're scared of everything other, then soon we will start these policies that affect everyone who's other than us. And so
truly, the most profound thing you can do is not worry about us, not worry about preemptive love. Go love your neighbor where you are. If you're doing that, as you're doing that, after you do that, we have profound financial needs right now. I mean, there are 1 million people headed our way, and we want to serve them with food and water and shelter and then long-term economic support. So you can talk to Brian about how to do that. Preemptivelove.org is how you can give privately online. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get more of kind of the news from the field on what we're doing in Iraq and Syria and places like that.